Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now.
Tonight is the second Tuesday. And you know, on second Tuesday, we have Ms. Ann Dillon, a licensed mental health worker that works with families and women and girls and relationships. Now, if anyone wants to make a comment or have a question, please dial 909-265-9215. That's 909-265-9215. Again, this is We Talk Production, one of the few Black-owned podcast radio stations that discuss Black issues as solutions. Tonight, Ms. Dillon is going to be discussing a very serious topic that is plaguing our communities around America, and that's domestic violence. This is October's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and she has Miss Mary E. May, Relationship and Marriage Therapist. Miss Dillon, are you there?
Yes, Rev. Kenny Jones, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Is Miss May from Philadelphia?
Mary, you know what? I have to ask her. I don't remember.
Well,
I think
you have a 26 number. Is that you, Miss May?
I'm here.
I think so.
Okay. Well, Miss May, I turn the show over to you.
All right, Brother Kenny. Thank you for having us another month, and this is the second Tuesday. So I always look forward to coming on your platform to share with your audience about healthy relationships. And like you said, tonight my special guest is Miss Mary May, and she is a relationship specialist, and she specializes in domestic abuse. And I'm so delighted because this month, while we're celebrating breast cancer awareness and we're celebrating so many different things, we are also shining the spotlight on domestic violence and what does that look like. So tonight, welcome, Ms. Mary. We're going to be talking about domestic violence in the African-American community. Welcome. How are you tonight?
I'm well. How are you?
I am well. It's great to have you. you have been a guest on Teen Talk Live, and it's really nice to have you on this platform as well to share your expertise with the audience.
I look forward to the great conversation and any feedback that I can provide.
Awesome, awesome. So why don't we start by you telling our audience a little bit about you and the work that you do in this arena.
In this arena, thank you for having me, first of all, as your guest. One of this very important conversation in our community. I have, since 2009, probably before that, but definitely since 2009, been very focused on educating people around the very multiple layers of violence and domestic violence and how it shows up, as well as shedding light on teen dating violence, because dating signs start as early in our teens and them navigating relationships. So from speaking engagements, traveling to the Eastern Caribbean, infusing film and media in the conversations, from the relationships I've had in both locally and internationally, educating individuals just around violence and the impact and the influence and how it impacts us from kindergarten through our adult lives, if you're in a home and growing up in violence, or if you're experiencing it as the perpetrator or the victim.
I think that is so important that we have these conversations, and they're not really easy conversations to have, but this
right.
is definitely an epidemic that has plagued our community, and we know that it's running rampant across the world, but we're specifically talking about the African American community when we state, you know, our community.
Correct. Okay. I mean, it's a global conversation, but I understand
mm-hmm.
for the purpose of this conversation, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's talk, Miss Mary, and I don't, you know, it's such a vast subject. I don't necessarily know where to start, but some of the statistics out there are so astounding around domestic violence, especially around intimate partner violence.
Right. And I guess, you know, it is a challenging subject, but I start from the education on what the violence and what domestic violence truly looks like, as opposed to from the back door speaking of it and assuming that the audience understands what domestic violence actually is, because a lot of people take it from, and the reason why it has the stigmas and everything, that they gotten hit or there's been some violent, you know, some physical aggression that was involved, when the violence actually occurs way before you get that intensity, and then when the exit planning happens, the life-threatening stuff happens, but the complacency and the codependency stuff happens way before it becomes physical. And I think that that's makes the conversation more solution focused, because the
yeah.
awareness takes away the stigma of, okay, well, now I can see myself in this situation and I can see myself working my way out of the situation.
I think that's so key. To have that, to lay that foundational knowledge so we understand where we're operating from, and we all have that language, because a lot of times when we think about domestic violence, when we think about domestic abuse, we go naturally to the physical, right?
Right.
Being hit, being punched, being choked, being strangled, and things like that, right? But help us
right.
understand some of these other manifestation of domestic violence. What does that look like?
So if I was to provide a picture, or, you know, to just kind of walk the timeline, we can go through the timeline of a relationship where you have the admiration for someone, and you may offer them gifts. You look to not have rejection in any particular way. But when rejection is introduced, and rejection could just be of not being available at the person of interest wants you to be available, or not responding to something that they found was very important to be involved with or responding to. And then jealousy comes in place because whatever you were focusing on more is now the intimidation factor and the distraction. And that distraction ends up taking a hold of the focus of what the person was asking for. And so then intimidation and bullying comes into play, where then now I have to win you over to get the amount of competition between you and whatever was the distractor, to get your attention to the degree and capacity where you can now focus on me to the same level that you do that. So then we're operating in that sense of what was the beginning part of an intimidation, and, you know, trying to figure out, okay, what is it that I need to do to be my optimal self, and what can I do to gain that person's full 1,000,000% of focus? And that's when it becomes the unhealthy boundary and the control factors and tracking you or finances and, you know, telling you you can't go to school or you can't go to work, because those distractors have more influence. We can also use the word power over your ability to give to me what I need to give me.
Well, see, but the interesting thing about that is when you're sometimes in a relationship, sometimes you think it's cute. Oh, my goodness, it's so nice. He is or she is just checking up on me all the time. Or, you
right.
know, they care so much about me that, they wouldn't dare let me go anywhere by myself. You know, it especially at the beginning of the relationship, that can feel endearing and that can feel really cute, or that you are so well thought about or thought of by this person that they're
right.
just so in awe of you. They want to be in your presence all the time.
Right, and especially for the teens who, you know, they may be modeling what they've seen in their living room from their family, you know, unfortunately communicating with the use of violence and think it's the norm, but it's also a matter of their self-love and self-view and self-preservation on what it is that they need to make themselves happy and feel in balance. So the checking on me or wearing my boyfriend's jersey if he plays on a football team, or, you know, the fact that somebody, like you just said, calling and checking on me, making sure that I'm okay and I have to respond to a text message with such urgency. And if I don't, again, that distraction and what comes in play, you know, thereafter is not so cute all the time. And we begin to make excuses is not so cute all the time.
Right, right. And I, you know, I've done shows talking to parents about some of the things to look for in their teenagers, but it is so important, especially one of the statistics that I've come to become familiar with is a lot of times couples who start out as teenagers, you know, they have a long-term relationship, there is a high likelihood that there is domestic abuse or domestic violence present in their relationship.
Right. Or the fact that they say, well, what I do doesn't influence my child. Yeah. And it really is a movie on telling them how to navigate and communicate, you know, with other people when they're in an intimate situation.
I think you're right on with that, because the children, they play out what they see, and there's a high percentage of, so there's one statistic, I think, that says children, a child who witnesses violence is 1 in 4, 22% more likely to experience the intimate partner violence.
Correct.
In their own life. So
the
child who sees their parents or experience violence in their home, it's likely, they're 22% more likely to have a relationship with somebody who will be abusive to them.
And the other perspective is if there is an individual who is of that teenage, you know, trying to emerge into the whole dating arena, if there has been a lack or an absence of just kind of building their character and showing them what a healthy, whatever, you know, unhealthy is arbitrary. So what a healthy relationship looks like to one person may look different to someone else. I just want to be clear on that, because, you know, different people look at healthy being defined differently as well. But once that child has grown up in a space where maybe they haven't received approval or validation or self-love, then that can manifest into their teenage and young, you know, college years, young professional years, relationships where they're navigating in the same premise of which they were filling a void. And as soon as someone interests them that's filling that void, they begin to not see some of the key signs or the telltale signs that would be those pre-dating indicators that violence is emerging or, you know, potentially a factor for the relationship to have those type of conversations.
That's so true. And again, the statistics are so astounding to me. A lot of times when we think about domestic violence and we think about domestic abuse, we think automatically of partners who are in intimate relationships. But the reality is 30 to 60% of perpetrators of intimate partner violence, they also abuse the children in the household.
Absolutely. And a lot of times, unfortunately, if that's what you're, you know, going back to my timeline that I had provided before, if you seem to be more attentive to the needs of the children, then what I will do to the child can sometimes be more intensified, because apparently that's the best solution. Or to get your attention, that I mean business, and I'm asking you to do X, Y, Z for me.
Yeah, that's true. And most of the audience might know that I am a clinician. And one of the things that I see is when women come to therapy, I investigate and I ask about, and men as well, I give them an assessment on what is abuse. And a lot of things that I bring up in the assessment, they have no clue that this is abuse.
Exactly.
And you alluded to that a little earlier in the conversation. So why don't we share with the audience some instances of abuse? Because I think people go into relationships and we're never really taught about healthy relationship and what's not and what's abusive, and we just kind of model what we've seen. So can we just spend a few minutes talking about what are some of the different types of abuse and what do they look like?
Okay. We definitely can probably agree to physical abuse that mm-hmm. generally escalates at the time that someone is deciding to leave the relationship, because then their life, the life of those who are near them, be it that they're in the same family with them or household with them or not, their lives are at much jeopardy just as the person in the relationship. You have sexual abuse. And sexual abuse, when I was talking about how they may harm another person, I kind of danced around it, but if you have a younger child who is in the home and say, I don't know, whatever the distraction that they're providing or interrupting or the identified reason for, you know, maybe what it is the person wants not happening, then they will begin to groom younger children in the home. And grooming means, you know, just kind of preparing them, persuading them, manipulating them, knowing what a child or a younger person would be interested in, and offering them that, which becomes that void that they begin to seek. So they begin to seek it to get approval and drawn into the situation where, you know, they can't make up stories that's going to continue. They have to protect everybody, basically.
I think grooming is a really important thing for our audience to really grasp what it is. And usually if a predator is grooming a child, they're usually grooming the people around them too, because they're doing everything in their power a lot of times to say, hey, I'm trustworthy, it's okay for you to leave your child with me. But then on the other hand, you're grooming the child to see the extent to which they will divulge information or share information or keep your secret. Yes.
If they see you as the breadwinner or the solid income that changes their trajectory and having to move so often or something like that, or ability to have food, you're changing their life overall situation from the lens of the child to being positive, then they want to do any and everything to kind of make you happy, and they don't know how many risks in which they put themselves in place of.
That is so true. That is so true. Okay, so we talk about sexual abuse, we talk about physical abuse. Okay, what other kinds of abuse?
We have educational abuse, where if you are in a training program or in school, or, you know, you feel more confident. You're like, okay, I'm getting the school in so I can get a better job. And maybe you're not able to make it to all of your classes, or if you go to class, you may have scars that you need to kind of hide, because in most of those situations, there is mandated reporting or people trying to support you, and you're trying to keep up your in regards to, you know, what's important to you, but they will limit all resources that you may need, financial aid, anything to interrupt the process of you being able to gain what you need to gain and study. So if you need books, you need paper, you need to go to the library, then they make it very difficult for you to have access, be it that it's transportation money or something like that.
That is so key, because when I do this assessment with my clients, a lot of them don't know about education abuse. They don't know that, you know, somebody starting or provoking an argument before a large assessment or a large test or a large project to throw you off guard, or to say, if you love me, you would spend time with me and not all the time studying. A lot of times they don't realize that that's a part of the abuse cycle.
Right. And the codependency, because it's like they're showing more of a need that really can resemble a lot. And this is a recent awareness through a couple clients, as well as teaching at one of the nearby universities, that it's a codependency. It's a codependency in the fact that it's a mutual toxic relationship to a degree. Not mutual that, you know, somebody is hitting on you, but if you look at the hitting as equally as the words, as equally as the removal of your flexibility to kind of move about and navigate, then it's all metaphorically the same, with the same level of toxicity, but it's a codependency there, because you feel like you need that part, and the partner feels like they have to control you for you to continue to believe that you need them, and you begin to figure out ways that, okay, well, it was temporary. If I just do, if I correct my behavior, then they won't do whatever the behavior is causing me harm or causing, you know, some type of disruption.
I think that's important. And I also think it's important that we kind of break down what is codependency. We talk about codependency and not wanting to be codependent, but I think for the sake of our audience and those who might not understand, you know, the clinical language, what is the simplest way we can explain codependency to those who are listening?
And that's such a great thing. And I'm like, okay, wait, how can I do this? I'm looking at Google so I can get some help. Let me see. Because just sometimes when you've had a long day, it's like, okay, wait a minute, let me see how I can make this simple.
Right. And I think when I, and you, while you, you know, you find that, because I just threw that in there, I think one, when I think of codependency, I think of being in a relationship with someone. And it doesn't have to be an intimate relationship, but being in a relationship with someone where you feel like you are, you cannot be your authentic self. You have to do different things that you need to do, and sometimes you don't want to do it to keep peace in the relationship or to keep that person connected to you or keep feeling like you are supportive of each other. So when I think about codependency, that's what I think about.
Definitely. Is definitely like, you know, poor mental health and immaturity, being irresponsible. The behavior, you know, it's like a core reliance on other people for the approval, you know, like the psychological, emotional, and physical approval of what it is that you're doing, which is almost like basically having a tantrum every single time that you have an interaction or a communication with each other. That's why it becomes that mutual dance, because you're dancing in the graces of, okay, what do I need to do to stop the aggressive behavior? How can I gain forgiveness? How can I, you know, change the energy in which this is, you know, shifting to? So it's really about the dance of trying to change the consequences from being painful, hard, you know, too, you know, I don't know, just too painful, too distracting, and who all is going to affect. Because, again, depending on the volatile nature of your relationship and who all is, like, within your home, everybody is at risk. But as I also mentioned, it could be a situation where they just know who's important to you, and if they can't get to you, they're going to get to that person.
That is so true, and you get caught in maintaining, I think in our clinical world we call it homeostasis, and that's just the practice of keeping things normal within your environment. So you do whatever you need to do to keep the peace or to keep things normal in your environment, whether you agree with it or not, and that's true codependency.
And it might also be at the time of shame and guilt, where your anxiety and fear is like really, really high. The control, the ability to kind of be caretaking and being able to regulate your own feelings and thought while protecting your boundaries.
Right. And I know that I've talked about boundaries a lot. Before I go to boundaries, because that's part of what you do, you need to have in place. Before we start talking about solutions, let's talk, give our audience a little more examples of abuse. What are some of the other ones?
So we have financial, educational, sexual, emotional.
Let's talk about financial a little bit. Financial abuse,
okay.
That is a big one.
That is a big one. And that's one that kind of goes under radar, because a lot of people would assume, and hear me say the word assume, that it's only, abuse only occurs in lower socioeconomic families. And that is the furthest from the truth. I know you were speaking from a statistics perspective before, and I don't have the statistics in front of me, but no class or gender assignment to when it comes to financial abuse. I mean, well, any layers of the abuse, but the financial abuse is no one set of group of people that this occurs for. In fact, if you are well off and have, you know, access to resources, depending on which role you play in the intimate dance that leads to violence, you may have no access to funds whatsoever and be only on where you earn a week, your incentive base, your
stipend
allowance. That's it.
Allowance.
Your allowance for the week. Yeah. So you may only have your allowance that's due to you for that week. And once you spend all of that, and they will track that you spent it all, because of course you can't save anything, because if you save, then you might get empowered and
right.
think about an exit plan. They give you the bare minimum, which I know when women decide, and this is like a jumping comment, and I just want to just put it out there, but I'll pull it back in. When a woman comes to a safe house, one of the things that they have to consider is planning a meal without meat, because at times the survival that in which you may go through, this is now a new narrative for you, that you have to learn how you can have a fulfilling meal in the absence of meat, especially as you have to build up your financial stability for you,
right?
Either you yourself or you and your family. It could be done without the use of beef and chicken and whatever else that you may be preferring to have.
Right.
But it's a survival method that is a teachable moment.
Right. And I think that's so key. And I think also when we think about financial abuse, we also think about the people who need to see receipts for everything that you spend, people who track your debit card, your credit cards. And not only that, but is someone changing the password without your permission?
Yeah, that's a risk taker.
Where you don't have access to the bank account no more because the passwords have been changed. That is considered financial abuse.
And you can also see this, as you were describing it, and you can also see that from a supervisee relationship,
yes.
The level of
mm-hmm.
control, and where you may say, okay, while I'm at work, it doesn't matter. It does matter, because the behavior is still the behavior, and the behavior
yes.
can still be very toxic and abusive in the workplace, just as it could be in an intimate relationship.
That is so true. I'm so glad you brought that up, because someone could be, you know, abusing you in the workplace, and they're saying, well, if you say anything, you'll lose your job, and, you know, you want to keep your kid in that private school or whatever the thing is that they're holding over your head to hold you hostage to their bad behavior, which is abuse.
Right. So that's abuse, as well as, you know, you keeping that job may be tied into your abuser. He may have referred you somewhere. So if they are working on solidifying a new contract, then they may put the heat on at home that you have to do XYZ to kind of make sure that they get the pleasing remarks to get the contract on the back end. So you may sometimes have a pivotal role in some of these abusive tactics as well.
That is true. And usually when you're dealing with an abuser, whether it's at home or in the workplace or at school, usually the abuser struggle with low self-esteem. And that is one of the key reasons why they want to exert power and control over someone.
Absolutely.
Mhm. Okay, so we talked about financial abuse. what other ones can we talk about?
I know that a lot of people, when I mention emotional, get confused with mental health. And with us both being systemic clinicians, I think that it's kind of helpful to kind of understand that, you know, you have depression, you have anxiety, you have different traumatic episodes that may occur from different layers in your life. That's mental health. The emotional abuse, I mean, and that's still like a cover-all statement on how I said that's mental health, that we can probably peel that back too. The emotional abuse would be you know, telling you, like just tearing you down from the words, tearing you down from, like, the actions, things that you thought were successful, they tell you it's the worst, or they think they give you no validation or no, you know, nothing to kind of say that it was the right thing or the wrong thing. Or they may say it was nice out in public, and then when you come in to the home, then they totally, like, just, the narrative is just so wild and disrespectful and non-affirming in so many ways that you're like, okay, wait a minute. We just put on this mask, and it's a mask, out in the community,
right,
and allow people to see us, to say that this is the best, you know, fundraiser that we could have done, or this is the best way that we could be in church if you're dealing with the bishop. This is the best way. You know, it's like whatever your relationship, it could have been the perfect thing when you were out in front of people, but then when you get behind closed doors, they're so demeaning with their words and their actions and their statements and discrediting everything that you did. If it wasn't meticulous enough, if it wasn't the setup of the table or the way that you decorated it, you didn't follow protocol, and you're like, okay, but I followed protocol, and we got tremendous compliments, you know, while we were out in the world. Why are you nitpicking? And nitpicking to see your reaction and your response, but that's the emotional abuse, because then that resonates with you and it stays with you, and you have that repetitive playing that tape over and over and over again, that you get, then begin to second guess your qualities and what it is that you bring to the table until you're able to break free.
And I think, you know, not that any abuse is worse than the other. They both have damaging psychological impact on you. But when I think about emotional abuse, you know, that one is so very tricky, because when you second guess yourself and you doubt yourself, you know, it's something you can't really pinpoint what's going on. You just know that it doesn't make you feel good. It doesn't make you feel valued. Someone might withhold their expression of love and affection for you because they want to inflict this emotional abuse on you. And the sad part about it too, Mary, is a lot of times people do these things and they don't realize what they're doing.
Right.
You know, that, and like we talk about,
it's a second nature to them. Like, you know your path of driving home every day. You know your path of in the morning if you're going to stop at Dunkin' Donuts. It's almost like your car goes there automatically. Like, you have your pattern.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they've been doing the pattern or the behavior as it's triggered so long until it just becomes, air quotes, normal. And you know, and that being arbitrary, but
yes,
still, like, very normal.
Right. I remember I had a couple and very esteemed professionals, and I took them through the abuse quiz, and they were just dumbfounded. They were like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that when I do this behavior, I'm actually being abusive to my spouse.
Right.
You know, and a lot of times we don't learn this. We fall into relationship and out of relationship, and usually doing and repeating the things, the patterns that we have experienced or have witnessed in our lives.
Right. And it could have been patterns that we experienced as young as children that was the imprint from things that our parents may have done, said, our grandparents, our aunts and uncles, we may have witnessed it and really was very dismissive to it. However, as it manifests and it planted its seed and we've gotten older, here we are, you know, doing those same very unsafe situations and making those same or similar decisions that, you know, just perpetuate, unfortunately, unsafe situations.
That is so true. And one of the other abuse that a lot of times we don't think about is technology abuse.
Yes, and cyberbullying.
Oh, stalking, bullying, the use of technology in a way like we alluded to earlier, you know, just blowing your phone up with texts and expecting you to respond immediately, calling 100 times and checking on you, and just this excessive use of technology. And it's so, it can, like with anything else, it can make you feel special in the beginning, but then it becomes quite invasive.
Right. Definitely.
Yeah.
Because even if you have credit cards and you're on your exit plan, it's just better to not use credit cards because it's traceable. It's everything that you do traces your steps for your location, for the purchases that you made, and people could put the puzzle pieces easily together through the steps that you make with your credit card.
Right. And also, along with technology abuse, is tracking devices.
Right.
And like you said,
you have
tracking
to share your location
purchases
with somebody.
Exactly. But tracking your location, that is something else. That is something that we need to be aware of. One other abuse that I talk about is spiritual abuse.
Definitely.
And we don't necessarily like to talk about that, but sometimes, and I've been a part of a congregation and a church body where it was, you know, the pastor was not okay with us fellowshipping with people who've left that organization or that denomination, and you know, holding people, you know, kind of hostage to say, well, God is not going to answer your prayers if you don't do thus and so, and if it doesn't feel good, chances are it's not good, right. But spiritual abuse and using the word of God or interpreting the word of God in such a way that holds you in bondage and in loyalty to a particular organization or a particular pastor is really, really damaging.
Absolutely. And even my colleague that I do a lot of work with, her abuser was the bishop, and she had, I think, a master's degree or had went back to school or some level of education that she was working on, and although what was occurring in their house didn't represent scripture, she was, you know, maintaining that mask. And when they decided to have a ministry around couples and, you know, how it was that they would manifest or work through domestic violence, he wanted them as a couple to be the lead. And although it was a compromising conversation, you know, she attempted to uphold what the request was because, of course, the alternative would be very aggressive and harmful. But that was her struggle. You know, how is it that, you know, our household doesn't reflect what it is that we may be teaching, and you want me to be the face of this, and it's just very, very compromising if I'm not living the same narrative.
Yeah, you're not living your truth.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Wow. So I think we've gone through and described. Did we leave any elderly abuse? That's another one that we see pretty common. So let's talk to our audience a little bit about elderly abuse.
Elderly abuse is when, you know, partners, especially, you know, now if they're seasoned, they've been together for, I'm going to just joke it out and say, a million years. They know each other's personalities. They know what makes them tick. They know what their triggers are. But as their bodies are changing and their medications are changing and their abilities are changing, the caregiver who is the most healthiest out of the two can be very, very intentionally mean and harmful. not only with words to each other. Now, they both can do words to each other that's emotionally harming, but they can do, like, withdraw medication and not give you the medicine that's, you know, maintain you not having the discomfort and pain that maybe your medical concern, you know, kind of exudes or... I'm just trying to think, like, they don't take you to your medical appointment, or when you go to the medical appointments and they go through the assessment of safety, you have been prepared and or threatened to not respond to those questions in a certain way because of, you know, what's going to happen when if you were to do that, you know, when you take your next bath, I'm going to possibly drown you, or maybe even play like they're drowning you, but then pull you up in time. So it's just so many things that people are actually living with. And again, this is across all socioeconomic levels. There's no prescription of ethnicity, financial ability, like any of those things that say it happens in this community more than others. This is across all lines.
Right, and it's important also to point out that this is not necessarily done just by the intimate partner, but it can be done by grandchildren. I've had so many cases where grandparents were raising their grandchildren, they become ill, and then they live in fear and absolute intimidation because of the treatment that they're receiving, whether from their children or grandchildren. So elderly abuse is something that really is running rampant across socioeconomic status, race, class, all of that stuff. And I think it's something that we need to pay attention to and look for different signs so that we can help our most vulnerable parts of the population.
And I think that also leads to the fact of the other conversations that may be stigma-driven in that our loved ones, when they become in their seasoned ages, they've always said that they have done whatever work that they've done to, you know, kind of have their final days in their house. But then the reality is some health concerns just don't allow for that, you know, transition to kind of happen that way. And families feeling safe enough to have that real talk conversation with, you know, the seasoned parent to say, okay, listen, I know that this was the plan 10, 15 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, but we don't have the capacity to do that. And just kind of being honest with that versus becoming resentful.
That is so true.
Feeling guilty and shameful.
Yeah. And I don't even like when people who are in their right minds and they just joke about, yeah, you know, I'm going to put you in a nursing home and, you know, stuff like that. It just sends a bad taste because if things happen to the degree that you're not able to take care of that parent, that can become really, really bad in the relationship.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And toxic. Yeah. I mean, because then it's like, were you planting the seed, you know, were you planting the seed all along, or, you know, did it something that just happened to become a reality, something that we joked about for many, many years before?
I think that is so true. And like I said, I definitely don't like joking about that. But I think as our audience is listening, if you have questions for us, we're winding down into the fourth quarter of the show. But if you have questions for us, definitely call in and let us know how we can help you and help you meet your needs and answer these questions as we observe domestic violence and domestic abuse month, because it's a conversation that we need to continue to have outside of October, right? As long as we're in relationships.
And we're trying to do everything 365. Like I do host a symposium, and I tried to do it in the month of October where I had my speaking engagements and other people's events to support, and I was just like, okay, this is just too much. And so I moved my whole conversation to April just because I feel like it's something that goes on all year round, and we need to keep this on the table, you know, as much as possible.
I have a question.
I think that's true. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Come on in with your question.
I have a question. Why do the victim stay in a relationship so long when they're being abused? Like you said, in the beginning, it might be dealing the texts, the technology, and the tracking, and what have you. But after a year or two, it could become somewhat overwhelming. So why do a victim will stay in that type of relationship?
All right.
Because of the dependency? I don't know, Tom.
I'm like, okay, is that question to me?
you go first, and then I'll go.
Okay. I think it's a very loaded question. I think it really falls strong into the stigma, because the stigma drives how we make that decision as a person who may be in that situation, if you should stay or if you should go. One, if you go to who you identify as a safe person and say what is happening to you, the person receiving the information that you thought was going to be your best voice and advocate says, and it's no gender specific, but I'm going to say girl, mm-hmm. you got a good man. You got a good house. He done built all this stuff up for you. You would be wrong leaving him right now. Then that plays in your head. Okay, well, it's just temporary. I could just do better next time, or I could not have the eggs burnt, or I could make sure the dinner is prepared, you know, nicer this time. Or like they end up taking self-blame and responsibility to why the abuse occurs versus just really being able to say, okay, I'm stepping out on faith. Because when they go out to the community, be it church, be it their aunt, be it whoever they felt was a safe person, they don't give them that first affirmation and confidence that they need that they can do it independently. So it's like they have to build themselves back up to navigate being independent and not having to identify themselves and being connected to someone else. Because at a certain age, you're not supposed to be single. At a certain age, you're supposed to have X amount of children. At a certain age, it's like all of these social constructs, you're fighting against all of them and trying to be safe and live. And if you have no stable background to kind of say, okay, you know what, if the pastor is not going to support me, I'll find me a new church. If I have no finances, I can go to the shelter and just chalk it up and live in the shelter for X amount of time. If my family is turning their back on me because that's a good man and they're getting their stipend while I'm getting my butt beat, or they feel like the image-wise, it keeps our family looking good because he's, you know, a successful business person, I can't be the sacrifice for that. It takes that independent stance to say, I'm no longer codependent on this situation, and I am more than capable to love myself and my children and anybody that I am responsible for, to say I have the capacity to leave and not turn my back. But then even when you exit, you may exit 2 to 3 to 4 times before the final exit is your final exit. And when you go to exit, and if you were to go back, it becomes more unsafe for you because you was able to fall through my fingers. And if you fell through my fingers, then I need to choke you a little bit harder. I need to restrict you a little bit harder. It's a very difficult capacity, and we always look at the person who should leave, and we never talk about the healing that needs to happen on the person that's causing the pain. Because hurt people hurt people. And whereas they are doing what we can identify as the most pain, we don't know what their struggle is. Nobody identifies mm-hmm. what their actual struggle is and how it is that they also need to heal. So it's a dual-edged sword on why they stay. It's a codependent dance. And in order to be successful, I have to know confidently. You have people who don't experience violence that aren't confident that they can live independently on their own outside of the structure of the social construct that says that at a certain age you're supposed to be in a relationship.
That is so true. And here is another key reason why people stay, because of lack of finances. If your finances are not in order, you don't feel like you can support, you know, I can't support my kids, I can't support myself, I haven't worked, or my money isn't enough. But finances play a big role in why people stay in an abuse, domestic violence situation. And I think one of the things that I really want to do before we wrap up is I also want to give the hotline number. So there's a 24-hour statewide hotline. I'm going to give the number for the state of Georgia because we live in Georgia, even though every state have their own hotline. So for Georgia, 1-800-334-2836. Again, that's 1-800-334-2836, and that's a 24/7 hotline to get support and help with domestic violence. Well, Mary?
Yeah.
Say that again. You have the national hotline?
I was just going to say the national hotline for domestic violence that would transfer you to your local places throughout the country is 1-800-799-7233.
Okay, again, that's 1-800-799-7233,
okay.
And that's the national
mm-hmm.
hotline for domestic violence. And you know, when people call, just know that you'll have support on the other end. It's not somebody forcing you to leave or take any actions that you're not ready to, but just someone to be able to hear you out and give you some support and point you to local resources.
And you can call
well,
as many times as you need.
You want to. Mary, thank you so much for joining us tonight and sharing your
expertise. Thank you. It was so
informative.
Very informative.
Yes.
Thank you for the invitation. And anytime you guys want me to come in and join the conversation, just give me a holler. I am always willing to share insight, peel back the layers so that we can have individuals and families safe, both mind, body, and soul.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
And Brother Kenny, I'm also going to say, even to the professionals, I have a lot of professionals who come in who are experiencing domestic violence. Even to the professionals, you can also get help through your job, your local, your job's EAP, Employee Assistance Programs. They have resources for you, so you don't have to suffer in silence. So anyone who feels
this
like
behavior is a very serious negative behavior that's not only plaguing on adults, but it's plaguing on teens and children.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not cute to not feel like you're somebody's equal. It's not cute to feel intimidated, or it's not cute to feel like somebody has power and control over you. It's deadly.
Right. Right.
Okay. With that note, well, Sister Ann, I guess I see you next month. Miss Mary, thank you for coming on the show. I really
Absolutely.
Appreciate it. Okay.
Thank you again. Thank you again.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Kenny. Have a great month.
All right. Will do. Okay, folks. That's a wrap. And a very lot of information. I hope you take this information down. I hope you follow up if you're in a relationship that's very toxic. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am. Please listen to this information. It might save your life. With that note, I'm out of here.
Hold it now!